Hi, everybody, and welcome to podcast number 12 of the Alexi Sale podcast. And boy, have we got a show for you. Well, we have a show for you. So, yeah, statements are fucking obvious, isn't it? Now I'm going to throw to my posse, Talal, like
hello.
The Steve Wright Show. Woo-woo-woo.
Hello. Oh, thank you, please.
Yeah.
How's it going, mate? All right.
Yeah, how are you?
Good. I'm feeling very unprepared at the moment, actually. It's a bit frustrating. About two very specific things. I've got my first stand-up gig since before lockdown coming up.
Right.
And I've written no new material apart from a song about hummus.
Okay.
That's the only new thing I have. And so that's about 2.5 minutes covered.
Right.
And I'm kind of bricking it.
It sounds like an anxiety dream, but it's real.
I did have an anxiety dream the other day as well.
Oh, I'm not surprised.
I kept making a mess in my underwear in a dream over and over again. But let's not get into that. Yeah, so I'm a bit panicky about that.
Get Linda to analyze that, yeah.
And it's a really good night that I'm really fond of called Arabs Are Not Funny, with some really great British Arab comedians that I really respect. And I'm just going to be doing the same fucking stuff that I was doing last time. And I need to write material quick.
Yeah, you need to write some material fucking quick, I think. Is it a tryout night or is it a night where you're supposed to bring your A game?
Yeah, it's a paid gig indoors.
I think the listeners should send you in some material.
Okay, yeah, maybe send me in some.
Maybe the Arab ones, yeah.
Send me
you could either use your own material and just say, you know, what about that coronavirus, say, and then do, you know, where a line where you had before Saddam Hussein, you just put coronavirus instead. That's one way to artificially kind of contemporize. I used to have this line I used to do for years live. What was it? It's probably quite, I'd pretend to cough and then I'd say, I keep getting a frog in my throat. And then I keep getting a frog in my throat. And then I'd say something about Charles Aznavour, which is, you know, you couldn't do that now anyway. But then after a while, I thought, on so many levels. And then after a while, I updated it. I changed it from Charles Aznavour. I changed it to Gerard Depardieu.
Oh, nice.
That's as much as I did.
And then now you could change the frog to COVID, but then that would remove the French connection.
Yeah.
So then you'd have to change Depardieu to like Matt Hancock or something.
It's you can't do it on so many levels, I think, really. Oh, that's my phone.
Your fucking doctor never leaves you alone.
Potential fraud, it says.
Put him on air.
A potential fraud. It was Jack Whitehall calling me. Hey, what? Kaboom! You see, I'm making up material.
That's hot shit. Can I steal that?
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
All right. So just do my old material, but say COVID instead of whatever the punchline was.
Yeah, yeah. And that would be
something about Depardieu. All right. Great.
Yeah.
Thanks for the tip. And in fact, the only other joke I've written over lockdown is the most dated thing I've ever written. It's like the Italian prime minister was addicted to going to strip clubs. So his advisor told him burlesque only. And that's like 5-6 years old now. But it's my latest joke. So yeah, okay. I should just say COVID instead.
Just say COVID.
Great. Yeah. Hey, Lex, I've got a couple of interesting emails that I think might be interested in. Thank you, please. Well, we've got people like Oliver and Leslie and Rich asking about politics. They want to hear more political stuff. They're sick of all these jokes and comedy bits you keep doing. And in fact, I have an email from someone called Paco.
Sí, hola, Paco, ¿qué tal?
¿Qué tal, Paco? ¿Qué pasa contigo? With your obvious great knowledge, Alexi, of all things Spanish, could I suggest topics such as the demonization of Podemos and Pablo Iglesias a la Jeremy Corbyn, Rayo Vallecano, the left-wing Madrid club with a great social conscience, and the amazing international brigadiers who came here to fight fascism? Keep up the good work, Frankie Taylor, Madrid. Was your name Paco or Frankie?
No, it's like his nickname, Paco.
So in essence, wants to hear about Spanish politics and Spanish history from you.
Well, that is amazing. It's like the world aligns to kind of orientate it towards my podcast. Because, funnily enough, I mentioned a while ago on a podcast that I would like to do an A to Z of left-wing thought. And I thought, and so I thought that I could start with anarchism. Now I thought, who would I like to talk to? And I thought of Professor Paul Preston. It's not somebody that I knew, but he's Scouser, and he became like the most famous person in Spain by writing about the Spanish Civil War. So I emailed Professor Preston, and he replied very enthusiastically. So. Yesterday, I went to Professor Preston's house and I recorded a long interview with him about the Spanish, about anarchism, because you can hear what I say in the interview, really, about why I chose him to talk about anarchism, and then the Spanish Civil War. And then we got onto contemporary Spanish politics, but I think we might do that in a separate edition. But it's a fascinating interview. He doesn't necessarily, he's kind of less left-wing in some ways and more left-wing in other ways than I thought, really. But he's got some amazing things to say about Spanish history, the Spanish Civil War, George Orwell specifically. And also there are lessons that can be learned, I think, because there are some extraordinary contemporary parallels with now. So this is me in the garden of Professor Paul Preston, Emeritus Professor of International Wombats at the London School of Economics and diehard Everton fan. A little while ago, I promised you all an A to Z of left-wing thought. So I thought I'd start with anarchism, really. And then I thought, well, who's going to talk to me about anarchism? And then I've always been a fan of Professor Paul Preston, Scouser, but also I think Britain's leading expert on Spain. What, you're Emeritus Professor of...
I think my official title is Emeritus Professor of International History at the London School of Economics.
Right. But I mean, so Spain, I thought anarchism, because Spain is perhaps the one place. Well, we can talk about the Spanish Civil War, modern Spain, but also about anarchism. I was just reading your book, A People Betrayed, I think your latest book. And it just, you notice the Guardia Civil are, all over Spain. But you talk in the book about how they spent most of the 19th century not, catching criminals or anything, but suppressing anarchism, really. And I suppose Spain is the one country where it seems to me anarchism has been the country where it took hold the most, political anarchism. I don't know whether that's true or not. And there's been a great fight against it. And also during the Spanish Civil War, there were examples of it being put into practice. So all that, really. So anyway, yes. Yeah, so.
Well, no, I think it is absolutely the case that Spain is the country which has had the largest anarchist movement. I mean, by the time of the Civil War, the CNT, which was the main anarchist or anarcho-syndicalist union, had, 3 million members. I think, there's countries in Latin America, particularly Argentina, where it was big-ish, but never quite on the scale.
So could you just tell us a bit, what is anarchism, really?
this is the how long is a piece of string question. I mean, anarchism is all things to all men. I mean, basically, it is a doctrine of freedom, of people making their own choices, of not being constrained by a repressive state. It has all kinds of elements, you know, free love. But free
sounds
love,
great.
Well, free love constrained by a high sense of responsibility, loyalty, and so on and so forth. But of course, you know, it changed over time. So in the case of Spain, what actually happened was that the anarchism came to Spain, bizarrely, from Russia via Italy. One of the earliest theory, I mean, obviously the theory goes back to the Greeks, but in modern times, the most famous, I suppose, you know, there's a pacifist version of anarchism, which is Tolstoy. The more violent version is Bakunin. Okay, so one of Bakunin's disciples, who was an Italian, and stop me the minute you can't stand any more of this.
I'm fascinated.
One of Bakunin's disciples was a guy called Giuseppe Fanelli. And Fanelli did a kind of tour round villages in the south of Spain where, you know, you can imagine the social injustice was, you know, and therefore social hatred was very considerable. I can explain that why if you want. And the accounts of this by, you know, that remain of people who heard him, you know, he was talking to people in Italian. He was going on, "Es spaventoso, è orribile," and so, but you know, A, with a passion, but B, you know, using words that meant something to Spaniards and so on. And bizarrely, thanks to Fanelli, anarchism caught on. Now, at first, it was very much in tune with the, shall we say, the more idealistic version of anarchism that I was talking about before. But obviously, in order to result in any society, in order to resolve social problems for the workers, you need some kind of unity, you need some kind of organization, and that moves you on to a form of trade unionism and so on. And so two things happened. One, within the anarchist movement, there was a kind of division between those who saw the answer as working within the system using trade unionism and those who went for the politics of action. In other words, you know, destroy bourgeois society. And in both cases, they were radicalized by, as you said a minute ago, by the repressive machinery of the state. And so what happens is, particularly in late 19th century Spain, you get, it was called the anarchism of the propaganda of the deed, and you get some quite frightening atrocities committed, particularly in Barcelona, you know, blowing up an opera house, you know, I mean, sort of pretty, you know, pretty gruesome stuff. And so there is effectively a social war being carried out right up to the Civil War, of course. And the other problem is that anarchism obviously begins with a base in the south, in the countryside in the south. There's lots of emigrants go to Barcelona, so it then gets a kind of base in Barcelona. The other working class movement is socialism. And that tends to be, you know, shall we say, slightly more sophisticated. It's found in industrial areas like the Asturian coal mining industry, in the Basque shipbuilding industry, and so on. And there's, you know, if you look at the history, it would make sense for them to have unified. But of course, there's always this hostility between them. Yeah, absolutely. And this, you know, this is a problem throughout. Now, unless I'm going to go on straight into the Civil War. See, one of the things is that, as people probably know, I mean, Spain wasn't involved in the First World War. So bizarrely, Spain didn't go into the war, but the war came into Spain. So Spain, it's a really strange story, actually. Spain benefited massively from the First World War because it could sell to both sides. So anything that could be moved, industrial goods, agricultural produce, was sold to both sides. And huge fortunes were made, but by industrialists and big landowners. The consequence for ordinary people was, of course, shortages, because anything that could be moved was being sold, and huge inflation. So this intensified social discontent. And there was a revolutionary movement in the late summer of 1917, which broke down basically because of rivalry between the anarchists and the socialists. You know, anyway, so it was cut a very long story short. It was a failure. But the, you know, the social issues remained, and basically, you know, the establishment, the landowners, the industrialists, the bankers, protected themselves in 1923 with the establishment of a dictatorship. Now, as I try to show in this book of mine, this recent book of mine that you mentioned, that regime of General Miguel Primo de Rivera was just eye-wateringly corrupt. I mean, it's actually one of the, not that it's a comical book, but the funny bits in the book are in that chapter, because Primo de Rivera was like an early version of Trump. So obviously he didn't have Twitter in those days, but he used to have these things, his daily notes. And of course he was a, you know, he had, shall we say, he had an industrial, social and sexual life. And he'd come in the early hours of the morning, three sheets in the wind, and he would dictate the day's note, which very often had to be retracted at midday the following day. And the corruption was just absolutely mind-boggling. So again, to cut a very long story short, his regime came to an end. It was unsustainable. And in April 1931, a democratic regime was established, the Second Republic. The problem was that for the anarchists, their view was, it's all bourgeois society. You know, there was no sense of how can I, you know, what would be realistic? What would be a realistic set of objectives?
Right.
So one of the, I mean, there's all kinds of problems that face the Republic. I mean, for openers, centuries of social injustice.
Yeah.
But the hostility of the anarchist movement was very powerful. Was one of the things that undermined.
You'd say that was a failing, was that kind of all that, well, I mean, it's perhaps a failing on the left, but particularly in anarchists, that kind of uncompromising refusal to modulate in any way.
Yeah, I mean, it's a bit of, if I could make a contemporary analogy, it's a bit like, you know, Corbynites hate Starmer so much that they'd be perfectly happy never to get into power rather than make any adjustments.
Mind you, I'm like that. So. So I can't see anything wrong with that personally. But
well, you know, it's all down to, you know, how pragmatic do you have to be in order to get into power. Now, okay, so one of the big problems of the Spanish Republic is that the first government was a coalition, and the two principal parts of that coalition had complementary, but actually quite, when put together, quite provocative ambitions. So, okay, on the one hand, you had what were called the Republicans, nothing to do with American republicanism. They're basically the liberals, so the liberal intellectuals. And their objective was to break the power of the Catholic Church, to break the power of the army, which in Spain, the army, the high command of the army, assumed it had the right to dictate politics. So they were their two big ambitions. The socialists, their ambitions were agrarian reform and to improve trade union rights. And they both were quite happy with each other's ambitions, and particularly things like, you know, bigger education programs, because there'd been very little. Spain had eye-watering levels of illiteracy at this time, big on women's rights and so on. But the combination of those two things meant, so you're challenging, the socialist was, you're challenging landowners, bankers, and industrialists. And the Republicans are challenging the people, the church, who dictate hearts and minds, and the Praetorian Guard that protect those interests.
Right.
So it's already a difficulty. The second difficulty is the anarchists wanted revolution now. There was no, you know, there was no sense of, you know, this is going to take a while, because we're trying to deal with centuries of injustice. And, of course, every time the anarchists did something that was either against the right or indeed against the Republic, this was grist to the mill of the right, which literally, I mean, the Second Republic was established on the 14th of April 1931. Mid-morning on the 14th of April 1931, the King, Alfonso XIII, leave Spain. Doesn't abdicate. His view is, I am going, and you know, unspoken, in the hope that my followers will cause enough trouble that I'll be begged to come back. Okay, he leaves mid-morning. Mid-afternoon, they're already plotting the military uprising that starts the Civil War in July 1936.
Sounds like the right wing of the Labour Party. Sounds like Tom Watson.
Anyone who can lose weight with the speed he did, definitely. Anyway.
Just go back a bit. What could you detail more about the political thought of anarchism, really? In slightly greater detail?
It's actually very difficult because, as I say, it's...
That's one of the things where any knobhead can call themselves an anarchist, can't they, really? That's one of the problems.
Yes, right? It's, you know, no one gives me orders. It's very much, you know, free thinking, yeah. Free love, it's free beer, free everything. I mean,
what was Bakunin's kind of theory?
Well, Bakunin, of course, believed that it would be legitimate to establish an anarchist society if necessary, using violence.
Now, how would that work? Yeah. Sorry, go on.
Well, you know, that if you would cause chaos in anarchist society, in establishment society. I mean, the most extreme version of that theory was another Russian called Nechayev, who believed that you had to create sufficient, almost like Boris Johnson, you know, create enough chaos and, seize your chance. So basically, Nechayev was advocating, you know, bombing hospitals. Right. He wanted to see a total breakdown of, you know, bourgeois society.
What would the subsequent anarchist paradise look like? I mean, how would there be any government at all? Or?
Well, that was always a problem. I mean, the nearest, I think, that anyone ever got to it. I mean, obviously, it's a bit like Thomas More's Utopia. That's one, model. During the Spanish Civil War, of course, in the there were serious attempts to establish an anarchist utopia, and one of the problems was, of course, that it may or may not have been possible. Who knows? Because there was a war on, so it would have worked only had it been possible for, you know. If this is where you get all the contradictions, had there been a central command of the anarchist movement, which of course there wasn't because it was anarchism, right? But had there been a central command of the anarchism movement, they could possibly have phoned up General Franco and said, look, we're having a revolution here. Could you just hold off at your war effort, maybe, you know, 5 or 10 years, and then we'll start it. Once we've made our revolution, we start again. And that, of course, is the big problem. So in apart from the, leaving aside for a second, the consequences in terms of the civil war and the war efforts, now this undermined the war effort of the Republic. If you look at those areas, there's a huge literature on this, the areas where there were attempts to establish an anarchist society. Of course, it broke down very quickly because, okay, you abolish money. So how does that work? So you go onto a barter system, and then you have these vouchers. And, of course, people could write their own vouchers and so on. You know, it became really problematic. You know, so you'd, in a given village, you'd start a collective, and someone said, but hang on, that wheelbarrow is mine. Or, you know, you can't have them donkeys. I paid a fortune for them. I was saving for years. So you already see this clash. Right. Between, individualism, basic human nature, and, you know, the more idealist. And, of course, in the Spanish Civil War, the hardliners just, you know, they weren't having any of that. They just took it and whatever. I mean, a film which annoys me in many, many ways, Ken Loach's Land and Freedom, which I don't like because I think it gives a very distorted view of, you know, it's a bit like Cliff Richard's We're All Going on a Summer Holiday.
Yeah, well, if I could just interpose, because actually I just did a documentary for Radio 4 about the White Young Communist League, and a couple of people emailed me saying, you know, you're romanticising the communists, and, you know, we know that they caused, many, many deaths on the Republican side. And I think in a way, it's funny when I, and I'd internalized that kind of message via Orwell and Ken Loach that that was true. And when I spoke to you on the phone, you said you were very much of a different opinion. So I think that's really, so if you want to,
remind me in a minute, come back to that. The thing, but one of the interesting things, and it's a really great thing about Loach's film, is you may remember there's a debate about collectivization within the village. So this is in the film, and they're discussing precisely, but you know, you can't have that donkey, or you can't have that wheelbarrow, or whatever. And the people who were actually in that, they were extras. They were people from a real village, and although it was made in whenever it was 73 or 74, you know, it was made in the 1970s. Yeah. They were people discussing exactly the same problems as they affected them, and that is the central issue. Going back to the wider thing, I mean, you know, when I was much younger, I had much more sympathy for the anarchists. I am regarded as a dangerous red in Spain, but you know, I've become over the years, and it's very obvious if you read my book, A People Betrayed, I've become much more critical of the anarchists. And of course, one of the issues that one faces is this notion, which to me is absolutely ludicrous, that the Spanish Republic lost the war because it didn't let the revolution happen. Well, there was no way in a million years there was a revolution going to happen when there was a war on, because all of the, you know, the key day-to-day exigencies were a centralized war effort. Now, if production had gone to hell in a bucket, I mean, there are some amazing studies of the fact that, you know, people used to take more and more sick days in Barcelona. You know, there'd be other places where people would be working their tripe out. I mean, it is all very, very complicated. As far as atrocities are concerned, okay. Now, it is the case, okay, that in order to classify or categorize atrocities, you need names. You need to know the names of the dead. And this is really complicated. Now, people who were killed within the Republican zone, we know to within 100, it was 50,000. And the reason we know is, A, at the time, the Republican authorities were trying to keep track on what was happening. You know, why is there a body in the gutter? And then when Franco took over, there was a huge government investigation and so on, which came up with numbers in the hundreds of thousands. I'm not bore you with the details, but we now know as a result of very, very solid research, it's 50,000. On the other side, it's been very difficult. Serious research only been possible really the last 30 years or so. And we now have 135,000 names that, you know, we definitely know that. And because of the places that have not been investigated, we know it's got to be 150,000 plus. So it's three times as
many. That was killed by Franco.
Killed by the Francoists.
Yeah.
Right. Now, that's the big difference. So first of all, there's a big quantitative difference. The big qualitative difference is, of course, that murder, gang rape, etc., these were deliberate instruments of policy. It was actual policy of the military rebels. That's easy to prove. Whereas in the Republican zone, most of the atrocities, which are still appalling, but were committed, if you like, against the will of the authorities. Because one of the consequences of a military coup is the apparatus of the state collapses. So it's, you know, it's easy, and the prisons are opened, and you know, it's all a bit of chaos, you know. So who were the 50,000 people who were killed? Because obviously, if people are saying, oh, it was all the communists, well, no, it wasn't. First of all, there was a lot of random killing. Understandable, because as news of atrocities came, you know, people, refugees fleeing from areas where Francoist atrocities were taken, there would be acts of reprisal. You know, prisons would be attacked and so on. But one of the things I think that, and you know, it is very difficult to say, because I would say the anarchists are more responsible than others, but you know, that's a lot to do with how young people were. You know, the younger they were, the more militant they were likely to be. You know, and there are extremists in the Communist Party and in the Socialist Youth, and, you know, etc. But overall, if I had to say, you know, I would suggest, you know, there's a degree of common criminals let out of prison. There's anarchists. You know, there's a bit of everything. Most of the accusations that you hear against the communists give the impression that, you know, the communists were absolutely run by Soviet agents, and that they massively killed members of the POOM, you know. The
yeah, well, that's all kind of Orwell's line, isn't it? Yeah.
It's simply not true. How many NKVD agents do you reckon were in Spain during the Civil War?
No idea.
Okay, okay, so they're rotated, so not all there at once. 13 in the course of the Civil War.
Right.
Now, who they were after, who they were killing, were foreign Trotskyists. That, you know, they were Trotskyists who were supporting the Republic and the international brigades and so on. So it was a very, I mean, I'm not defending it.
Yeah, but
it was
it's not exactly cricket, is it?
No, but it was a very specific, you know, it was targeted. Right. It was very targeted. And otherwise, I mean, I spent years doing this. I wrote a book called The Spanish Holocaust, which is about both sides and the innocent civilians killed on both sides. And I investigate in depth both sides. But the, you know, if you like, that myth, and I think it is a myth. Again, I wrote something on, I hope, completely debunking Homage to Catalonia. I mean, that book, you can take it apart. He talks as if he knew Spanish and Catalan. He didn't. So, you know, some of the conversations are clearly invented.
Even though he's an old Etonian Trotskyist, I believed him completely.
He wasn't a Trotskyist. What happened? I'll tell you. It's interesting. I will send you the article. Later today. When Orwell wanted to go to Spain, he went to see Harry Pollitt, who was then the Secretary General of the British Communist Party, and Pollitt didn't trust him. You know, he sort of said, bloody Etonian, you know, posh git, et cetera, et cetera. And he wouldn't let him join the international brigades. So he linked up with the Independent Labour Party, which was so, you know, had Trotskyist sympathies, shall we say. And he ended up in a POOM militia. Now, the POOM would always deny that they were Trotskyist. Now, obviously, the Secretary General of the POOM, Andreu Nin, had been Trotsky's secretary, translated all his works and so on. So, you know, but they'd had arguments. But you know what it's like? I mean, broadly speaking, I don't think it's offensive to say the POOM was quasi-Trotskyist. Mm-hmm. They were certainly virulently anti-Stalinist.
Yeah.
And so, you know, Orwell ends up with this particular group, Fair Dues. He also, completely by accident, ends up in Barcelona when the balloon goes up on the 3rd of May, 1937. Afterwards, when he comes home and he's writing his book, he actually does a letter, I think it's to Cyril Connolly, in which he says, you know, I'm writing this, and out of a sense of fair play, I'm being much kinder to the POOM than actually I really think. And you think, well, that's all well and good, you know, but this is a book that, while it did nothing at the time, is probably the book in English that most people have read about the Spanish Civil War.
Yeah,
almost certainly, you know. And so their view is, you know, why did the Republic lose the Civil War? It was because of Stalin. Well, you know, I'm no fan of Stalin, although I do think, you know, supported the Spanish Republic is one of the few good things he did. But, you know, you think, hang about. Before you start blaming it all on Stalin, can we just hear a shout for Franco, Hitler, Mussolini, Neville Chamberlain? You know, it's so unfair. And I do think that,
that's really interesting. I think that's, you know, I mean, even as I say, I think I'd subconsciously absorbed that narrative of the Orwell narrative, really.
Well, me too, when I started out, you know.
I think we've got a scoop here. I think George Orwell was a lying bastard, lying old Etonian bastard. If this was 1939,
I think that you don't need to say that. You just say you went to eat.
Yeah.
what you've got to remember, it seems to me anyway, that you know, throughout the 1930s, obviously, Russia and Stalin were the villains. During the Second World War, this had to be changed. There was a massive propaganda effort. So suddenly, the Russians were our gallant comrades. Evil Joseph Stalin was turned into benevolent Uncle Joe. All of that. I mean, there was a massive propaganda effort, okay, and which you know was understandable and necessary. Come 1945, when the Cold War started, that all has to be reversed. Now, in the States, this is done very skillfully. So you've got a number of scholars, Brzezinski, for instance, and their views are transmitted then through the Reader's Digest, massively through the Reader's Digest, and then through the press in the Midwest. So this whole idea that, and it starts off, so, okay, we thought these people were our friends, but actually they're as bad as the Nazis. So there's this whole effort to equate Russian communism and German Nazism.
Now we're seeing that raising its head at the moment as well,
So that is very, very cleverly done. And of course, if you look at the kind of pyramid of these ideas at the top, the scholarly views, there are a lot of similarities, sort of sociological similarities. What sorts of people were executioners for the NKVD? What sort of people, in terms of family background, education, et cetera, et cetera. Of course, there are similarities, And so by the late 1950s, I think what has happened is that communism is being denigrated massively, with a lot of the Ukrainian famine and all that kind of, there's a lot of raw material to help that. But I believe that the one thing that was the jewel in the communist crown, as it were, the one thing that remained was the Spanish Civil War. There's the famous statement by Albert Camus, that it's the one war that people still think it was the last great cause. And I think that is still true. And I think it was a very powerful idea at the time. What happened? Within the Congress for Cultural Freedom, which financed magazines like Encounter.
Yeah, because I talk about this on the podcast, I think in a previous edition, about how Encounter also financed ideas of abstract expressionism, didn't it? As a kind of counterbalance to socialist realism,
So basically, the Congress for Cultural Freedom has a Spanish language branch. So, I mean, obviously there's a German branch, there's a German equivalent and so on and so forth. But the Spanish one was immensely powerful, very well funded because of Latin America as well, where, of course, there's a lot of Spanish emigres and so on. And so the person who was picked to run it is from the Poom.
Aha!
So he's a guy called Joaquín Gorkín.
Right.
And Joaquín Gorkín was one of the leaders of the Poom. He was lucky that, unlike Nin, who was assassinated by the NKVD, and I give full details of that in my book, The Spanish Holocaust, how it was done. I mean, he was framed. It was just the most, almost laughable, the crudity of the framing. But anyway, Gorkín escaped. One of the things, actually, going back to what we were saying a minute ago, regarding the notion of massive atrocities committed by the communists, extraordinary against the Poom. The Poom leadership was put on trial. The Republican Prime Minister, Juan Negrín, the Minister of the Interior, Julián Zugarragaitia, and the Minister of Justice, Manuel Irujo, all appeared for the defence, and every one of them managed to get out of Spain at the end of the Civil War. Whereas, on the other side, anyone who was, just wiped out. So, basically, Joaquín Gorkín, and this is a phenomenon, not quite sure if there's a scientific term for it, but there are people like who go so far to the left that they somehow meet the extreme right round the back.
Right.
So Gorkín becomes a well, he's the lead, he's the head of the Congreso para la Libertad de la Cultura, as it was called, and writes lots of books. And the claim is, thank God the Spanish Republic didn't win the Civil War, because if they did, they would have established, Spain would have been like Poland or Czechoslovakia, which is it's a chronological absurdity.
Right.
Poland and Czechoslovakia and Hungary wouldn't have been the way they were had it not been for the Second World War.
Yeah, yeah.
And so basically, he was dead by now, of course, although he had collaborated. Remember Orwell, there was a famous scandal about names on the left that Orwell had handed to the security services.
Yeah.
But, maybe not Orwell, but Gollancz benefits. It is as a result of this, purely talking in terms of Spanish Civil War terms, that Homage to Catalonia becomes a book that sells and sells, and there are new editions coming out all the time. Gorkin did some terrible things, for instance. I don't know if you ever heard of El Campesino.
No.
Okay, El Campesino was one of the things that happened during the Civil War. There were a number of, self-made military leaders who were actually really good, who'd come up from the working class. So there was Enrique Lister, who'd worked as a laborer on the Moscow underground.
Right.
There were about four or five of them who were really, really good. One of them was this guy called Valentin Gonzalez, known as El Campesino. And at the end of the Civil War, most of these guys were taken to Moscow for training in the Frunze Military Academy. And El Campesino was thrown out because he was a rubbish student. And then he was sent to Siberia, and he escaped and allegedly walked from Siberia to Persia to escape. Obviously a very interesting bloke. He couldn't read and write, which probably wouldn't have helped his studies in the Frunze Military Academy.
Probably not.
But Gorkin falsified his memoirs, and there were all lots of stuff.
The same shit we see now, isn't it, really, Yeah, yeah. Do you think, it's interesting to talk, what do you think the implications are of the Spanish Civil War and all this for, socialism now, really? Do you see any...
I don't know, that might be a curveball
to throw you, really, with stuff, but
Well, I tend to, do believe very strongly that people don't learn the lessons of history. And, I'm not talking about the average Daily Mail reader.
Yeah.
But, Gabrielle, who you met earlier, she's a big fan of Corbyn, whereas I wasn't, because for me, he was making the same mistakes that the left wing of the Socialist Party in Spain made.
Right.
And I suppose, it was a bit, having an agenda that offended, that provoked resistance from a much more powerful right. Bear in mind that in Britain now, as in Spain, in the 1930s, the media is 95% controlled by the right. I think you have to take that kind of thing into consideration, unless you're prepared to go to all-out war, which the socialists in the 1930s Spain were in no position to do so. And only a tiny minority would want to do that in the Labour Party today. So as far as
Your wife disagrees with this, by the way.
Yes.
Get it in.
As indeed, on every issue, you do the next show with her. You would. I'm not kidding. You would enjoy talking to Gabrielle.
I want my views confirmed. I don't. You're challenging my views here. I don't. That's not what you do a podcast for.
Adelante. It's not that I say there is any militancy. Sadness, that, and the thing about, for me, of course, it's very, very difficult, isn't it? Professionally speaking, one of the problems that I have a colleague, also a Scouser, funnily, born within whistling distance of Goodison Park, Helen Graham, she's a great historian, and we see very much eye to eye on this, you know. And one of the issues that we're always buggered about is that historians of Europe, and so, you know, apart from ones who do all of Europe, the ones who do Germany, Russia, France, you know, the big countries, it's like Spain, you know, Spain's this funny little backwater. Whereas in fact, it's absolutely central to European history. You know, the Spanish Civil War was the rehearsal for the Second World War. And, you know, this is it's not a scoop, but it's not many people like me saying this, you know. If the people who made British foreign policy, Neville Chamberlain and company, had not put their class prejudices in front of their national interests or their strategic interests, it is possible that the Republic might have won the war. Had the Republic won the war, there would not have been a Second World War, because the only way the Republic would have won the war would have been if Britain had stood up to Hitler earlier.
Yeah.
You know. Now, our beef is that if at the level of very serious academic history, it is quite difficult to get the message of the Spanish Civil War over, what can we do? You know, now, one of the things, I have a project for school kids in Spain where my books are being translated into comics.
Right.
Which I'll show you later.
Actually, one of the things I found fascinating in your book, going back to the 19th century, was you write about this thing that they had in Spain called El Turno, which was basically there's two identical parties that basically took turns to govern and were sort of a kind of meet each other. Now, you say this is in contrast to the British system, but it seems identical to me in a way, you know. Well, but I mean, you can talk a bit more. I just think it's fascinating. Now. And then sort of, so one's called like the Democratic Christian Socialist or whatever. And one's, what's the two parties called?
One's called the Conservative Liberal Party and the other's called the Liberal Party.
Conservative Party, yeah. And they would get in touch with each other and say, we've been in government. We've had enough now. Do you want to rule for a bit?
Well, I think that's slightly,
that's slightly it.
But basically, I mean, there are differences, but they're minute differences. So basically, the Conservative Party represent the exporting agriculture of the big landowners of the South, the ones who, you know, sort of the Jerez, you know, sherry magnates, the agricultural exporters of the South. Whereas the liberals, they represent the wheat producers of the north. So one lot are more, so the southern ones, they're more in favour of free trade. The ones in the north are more in favour of protectionism. But bizarrely, the ones in the south, the conservatives, are a bit more conservative. So they're, you know, ferociously, but they're both monarchists. But obviously, I mean, they have enough in common that used to be difficult to get a cigarette paper between them. And so, you know, there are all kinds of devices whereby, so what happens is that the king is the person who decides when there'll be a change in government. And he gives the party that's out of power, if you like, a chit that says you can call elections. And they've got plenty of time to prepare the elections. And there's a kind of a deal, you know, that there's not going to be too much opposition. And they have all kinds of devices, all kinds of, you know, electoral fraud. If things are looking dicky in a particular place, they'll sign up the dead from the local cemetery. You actually have to dig them up. Right, it's, you know, an administrative exercise.
Yeah.
There are even examples of cows being, you know, lined up to vote. Again, I don't think they actually went to the voting booth. Yeah. There are all kinds of electoral fraud. I mean, the great story about this is the local bosses were called caciques. And there's one where the cacique of a place in, what the hell is it called? I can't remember the name of the town now, but it'll come to me.
Yeah, it's somewhere in the south.
It's in the south.
It's near.
He's in the casino, which is, of course, the rich man's club. It's not necessarily a gambling hall. And they're waiting for the election results to come down from Madrid. and a carriage, you know, the diligentia, as it was called, the carriage draws up outside the casino. Bloke rushes in with all the papers and they're given to the cathedral. And he leaves through it and he says, gentlemen, gentlemen, he says, you know, we, the Liberals, were sure we would win these elections, but God in his almighty wisdom has decided that victory must go to we, the Conservatives. Not a lot changed.
And that's completely different to what we have in Britain today. Well, I think on that point, that's enough maybe about historical Spain and anarchism. But I'd like to talk to you more about contemporary Spain. So we'll do that in a separate edition. Thank you very much, okay. Professor Paul Preston.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Okay, well, that was Professor Paul Preston. Read his books, The Spanish Holocaust, The Country Betrayed, and many others. They are fascinating. And I say there are, as he said, I think, in the interview, that there are people tend, because, you know, they tend to treat Spain not as, you know, central to European history, but really Spain is where, in many ways, everything happens. You know, in the 20th century, certainly. So that was an amazing interview, and we got more talking about more contemporary matters in Spain, maybe in the next podcast.
So if you remember a few episodes ago, Make It Jones on Instagram made Alexi a little figurine of his comeback to comedy look. Out of like random Lego parts, he managed to put it together and it looks pretty cool. He's wearing all black and holding a microphone. And we gave him a shout out on the show. And next thing I know, he sent in the post five more. He sent us five mini Lego Alexis with little certificates of authenticity that we'll get Alexis.
That's something that's worth having, isn't it?
It's, wow. What did you call it? You called it, yes, I'm very unprepared. I gave a disclaimer at the beginning of the show. You called it a noble enterprise is your words. That's it. There we go.
A noble enterprise.
Let me get these figures out. Let me get these guys out. So they're very adorably packaged. So he messaged me personally and said, "Hi, a few people commented they wanted to get a Lego Alexi. I've gathered enough parts for five comeback stand-up era figures. Can I donate them for the podcast as giveaway prizes or to promote the Patreon whip around or wherever might bring the most loot in?" let me know if that sounds okay. And there's this really cool picture of five of them in a row. I wasn't expecting them to actually be so tiny. They're so cute. They're really tiny little Diddy Alexis. I'm showing them to Alexi on the video call.
Yeah.
And there's these certificates that we want you to sign, Lex.
Okay. Well, I think that would make a fine prize. I don't know how we will. We were talking about maybe somebody who gives the most to the Patreon, like signs up for £10 a month or.
Or maybe I could reserve one or two of them for the Instagram and do something on the Instagram.
Yeah, whatever you want. Yeah,
because we want more followers on the Instagram. Alexis L Podcast. Alexis L Pod on the Insta. I like to do a bit of fun stuff on there. I put highlights from the episodes and some behind the scenes stuff. But the Patreon obviously would be the best way to get some. What do you want to do? We've been debating this, and I don't know because we did promise on the Patreon that you get nothing. There's nothing. There's no benefit from joining the Patreon. You just give us money, and that's it.
Yeah, which is that's noble as well, isn't it? I'm betraying myself if I start giving shit. But on the other hand, I sort of ricochet between arrogance and extreme neediness. So it's not unlike me, really. Tending more towards the arrogance than the neediness, but so it's like me that I would say you get nothing and then offer people Lego images of myself.
It would be cutting satire to suddenly like undercut our message and become a dictatorship and actually have a social class system And be like, actually, no. If you give £10 a month, you get a benefit. Actually, you're gonna get a little Lego. Lex.
Yeah, but then it makes everything that I've ever said ever hollow, doesn't it? Which is fair enough, really. Yeah, we'll think about it because I've also made. I'm supposed to be sending a video for everybody who has to be my friend for Christmas or something.
Yeah.
I haven't done anything about that either. So it's all empty. It's all empty, hollow promises at the moment. Rather like Keir Starmer. Ah!
Yeah. And as a side note, it's very odd because Make It Jones's Instagram, what he does is he makes gun holsters. These leather gun holsters. And I know you like weapons.
Yeah.
He hand makes
these. This is taking a whole new direction.
I found that fucking weird. I found it really interesting, but weird. And then, so it's just gun holster, gun holster, gun holster, and then a Lego Alexi at the top. So it's a very surreal feed.
I need some nice looking pistols there.
Do you like that stuff?
Mm,
yeah. I thought you'd like that. That's why I was scrambling to get his grandma.
Yeah. All right. that's probably. Would that be illegal if I said anybody who smuggled me in a Glock 17 with a couple of boxes
get
and nine millimeter? I'll tell you, somebody can provide me with a Glock 17.
No, cut.
Beretta.
No.
Beretta Model 92.
No, Alex, I love you and I love doing this show, but it's not worth. I'm not going to prison for you. I'm sorry. That's where I draw the line.
That would get you a Lego. All right. All right, we'll work something out anyway. But or maybe people have got suggestions. But
if you've got suggestions, send them in.
You definitely think it's not right. 9mm Glock or
no.
Browning high power. Oh, but reliable.
Maybe like a replica or a BB gun version.
I've got all that.
Look, whatever you do, whatever shady business you do, leave me.
He's got a shoulder.
Okay, yeah. So send us any suggestions on how to give away these Legos.
Yeah.
And we'll announce a competition of sorts or something on the next edition of the podcast. Does that sound fair?
Yeah. And if you are a serving member of the British Armed Forces, you can lose your sidearm and send it to me. Sorry.
I'm going to, before we end, can we just, as a palate cleanser, how about a nice, very short poem?
Okay.
This is from Catherine in the emails.
All right.
And it's a short poem about bike rides. On Monday, I cycled past you. You were sitting on the street outside a restaurant. If you had looked up to the road, perhaps you would have watched me on my bike ride. Instead of the other way around. Kathy.
That's nice. It's not quite a haiku, is it? But it's getting there.
No, it could be like a double haiku. Is that a thing?
I'm surprised.
But I thought it was very nice and pleasing and a very convenient way to remind our listeners that you can go to the Alexi Sale YouTube channel and catch our bike rides.
Epic. Oh, man, it's like
we went to Milton Keynes.
We went to Milton Keynes. It's like Beowulf, isn't it? It's like a saga. It's an Icelandic saga that's going to stretch over many, many.
Yeah, months. It's like Beowulf, as in like it's long and rambling and doesn't seem to go anywhere until suddenly it does, and then there's a point, and you remember why you started reading it, and then you keep going and then forget. Again, it's beautiful. I think it's actually something, a work of pure art, and the Milton Keynes saga has begun. Go and check that on the YouTube. Check out please go to our Patreon, patreon.com/AlexisHillPodcast. Keep your emails and friendship applications coming in to AlexisHillPodcast@gmail.com. That's about it. I could keep plugging stuff. I could plug my podcast.
No. Let's. Let's
what about my podcast? Shall I plug that real quick?
Little Jody. Remember Little Jody.
Oh, shit. Okay, bye. Forget about that. Don't worry. I don't have any other podcasts. Bye, guys. No, that's your job. Say bye.
Bye. You've been listening to the Alexisale podcast produced and edited by Talal Karkouti. Music by Tarbush Records. Thanks to Anthony Overton for the sound mixing. I'd like to thank Audio Boom, even though we're now paying them, but you know, they're good to me. I think those are the best friends sometimes, the ones you pay, like you.
Shit. I'm going to waive my fee for this episode.
Just to prove we're really friends.
Yeah. Hey, man, man's got to make a living. I got to buy the bread, man. Got to buy the bread.
True that, yeah.
No, honestly, thanks for the opportunity, Alexei.
Fuck off. All right, bye-bye, everybody.